Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Living with Breast Cancer Treatment Updates. And today's program is going to focus on updates in the treatment of estrogen receptor positive, or ER positive, and progesterone receptor positive, PR positive breast cancer, and triple negative breast cancer. So we have a very ambitious program today, and we have wonderful speakers today. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And really, it's because of that collaboration and all of your interest in this topic. We have on the call today over 832 participants. And you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Bulgaria, Canada, Kenya, Lebanon, Mexico, New Zealand, Spain, Thailand, and Venezuela. So it really is a credit to all of you, both in the U.S. and internationally, who've chosen to join our call today. This activity today is supported by grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, Celgene, AstraZeneca, Eli Lilly and Company, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of the program and actually for the collaborative effort to make this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Harold Burstein, and Dr. Burstein is Breast Oncology Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Burstein is going to address an overview of ER-positive, PR-positive breast cancer, and triple-negative breast cancer, and understanding the role of diagnostic testing, new technologies, and personalized medicine. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Burstein.
Well, thank you all for joining us. So, as you said, it's an ambitious agenda because you're covering the vast majority of breast cancers by defining them in these ways. We now characterize breast cancers based on specific biomarkers that are tested every time there's a new breast cancer diagnosis. And often, if there's a recurrence of the breast cancer, we also check these markers again just to make sure we know what we're dealing with. And usually, we describe three markers. One is the estrogen receptor, or ER. The second is progesterone receptor, or PR. And the third is the HER2 protein, so-called HER2-new or HER2. And if the cancer is either estrogen receptor positive or progesterone receptor positive, we consider that cancer to be so-called hormone receptor positive and potentially very sensitive to anti-estrogen and hormone manipulations. And Dr. Laprinzi is going to be speaking about that. If the cancer lacks expression of all of these three markers, ER, PR, and HER2, it is called triple negative because it's negative for each of those three markers. And for those kinds of cancers, we commonly employ chemotherapy. And there's a third group of cancers that are so-called HER2 positive. Those cancers have a special set of treatments built around targeting the HER2 protein, and that's not the topic of today's call, but that's about 20% of breast cancer. So today we're really focusing on the 80% that are either hormone receptor positive or triple negative. Now, of those, the vast majority are hormone receptor positive. For younger women, about 60% of all breast cancers are hormone receptor positive. And for postmenopausal women, especially as they get older, more like 80 to even 85 or 90% of cancers are hormone receptor positive. So hormone receptor positive, ER positive cancers constitute the vast majority of breast cancer in the U.S. and other developed societies. So in addition to testing these, we've learned a lot in recent years about some newer advances in helping us to diagnose and think about these different kinds of breast cancers in ways that people often refer to as personalized medicine or individualized medicine. So the first thing that's really important is that you get high-quality testing for estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. And you would think this is a pretty easy thing to do in the pathology lab because they've been doing it for decades. But what's been interesting is that as there's been a push to assure high-quality testing, that not everybody does it so well. And the best predictor of a high technical success rate is centers that do a lot of testing. So reference laboratories or busy hospitals or major academic centers that do hundreds of cases a year seem to have, on average, more reliable results for ER, PR, and HER2 testing than do smaller centers which do fewer test cases. And that's not a big surprise. Almost everything in medicine points to the idea that high-volume centers, on average, tend to have slightly better quality results when it comes to technical performance than lower-volume centers. So, again, the most important thing is to get high-quality testing done. And actually, the American College of Pathology and other important cancer organizations have been coming forward with specific recommendations on how to make sure that there's high-quality testing. Now, beyond these basic markers of ER, PR, and HER2, one of the things that's happening is we are doing much more extensive genomic-type profiling nowadays to help us really understand the heterogeneity within these cancers. Sometimes these are called subsets of subsets. Sometimes they're called tailored approaches. But the real idea is to take these very big chunks of cancer, like ER-positive cancer or triple-negative breast cancer, and try and splinter them yet further into clinically important subgroups. So there have been a couple of strategies to do that. One strategy has been so-called genomic profiling, where laboratory scientists will look at the patterns of expression of genes within the cancer cell. Typically, they will look at somewhere between 10 and 100 genes to try and understand better the behavior of the cancer based on these patterns of gene expression. And the laboratories that do this are very technically able to measure amounts of RNA, which is the intermediate between the DNA of the cancer cell and the proteins that the cancer cell expresses. And they quantify the different species or types of RNA in the cancer cell, and they then use that to look at the so-called profile of the cancer cells. And this has been very informative because, particularly within the broad group of estrogen receptor positive breast cancers, it's led us to understand some important clinical differences. Using this molecular profiling, we have found that a certain group of breast cancers have lots of estrogen receptor expression, tend to be very slow growing, tend to be very sensitive to hormone therapies, tend to have lower grade if you look at them under the microscope. And these correlate with a couple of clinically used profiling assays, one called the Oncotype DX recurrence score, where these have a lower Oncotype DX recurrence score. The other assay that's often used here is a so-called PAM50 assay, and they call these the luminal A intrinsic subtype. These cancers tend to have a very good prognosis with antiestrogen therapy alone. They often do not need chemotherapy, and we're using this profiling increasingly, as Dr. Laprinzi, I'm sure, will discuss, to tailor our treatments for such patients. By contrast, there's a different group of estrogen receptor positive cancers that are not quite so favorable with hormone therapy alone. These tumors tend to have lower levels of estrogen receptor expression. They tend to have higher rates of cell growth or proliferation, and they have a different molecular profile. And these cancers we often call luminal B or call a higher score on the Oncotype DX recurrence score. And these cancers still benefit from antiestrogen treatment, but we increasingly offer patients with these scores or features chemotherapy just to make sure we get those good results in a way that hormone therapy by itself might not accomplish. So clinically, this is a very useful tool for ER-positive breast cancer. For triple-negative breast cancer, they've done the same kind of genomic profiling, and those have led us to identify very interesting subgroups of triple-negative breast cancer, but to date, they don't immediately lend themselves to treatment differences. We're still trying to develop drugs that might selectively act in some of those different molecular subsets of triple-negative breast cancer. And in the final minute or so, then, we'll speak to the other deep genomic kind of profiling that's going on, and that really is what they call next-generation sequencing. So increasingly, we are now offering sequencing of the entire cancer genome, or at a minimum, nearly hundreds of different genes, to look for specific mutations in genes that might lend themselves to targets as treatment for breast cancer. And this has been a very interesting, huge international collaboration, as well as multiple academic sites around the country doing this, and now increasingly commercial vendors offering this. And this type of large-scale genomic sequencing of breast cancers has shown us that a lot of ER-positive breast cancers have specific mutations in genes that we didn't know so much about. Those include the PI3 kinase gene, the fibroblast growth factor receptor gene, cyclin genes, and these are all potentially new treatments targets in ER-positive breast cancer. In triple-negative breast cancer, we're finding those mutations, but we're also finding frequent mutations in a gene called P53, which has historically been very difficult to know how to target, but there's now interesting work going on, as well as a smattering of other mutations. And in both sets of cancers, what's interesting is that about 1 to 2% of all the cancers have these very unusual mutations that might make them targets for other kinds of targeted anti-cancer treatments. So, for instance, we occasionally find a BRAF mutation in a cancer cell that's a breast cancer patient. These RAF mutations are very common in melanoma, but in about 1 or 2% of breast cancers, you find them. And now we're trying to think about, well, should we treat these breast cancers a little bit differently? So we've made rapid progress in recent years going from simple biomarkers, ER, PR, and HER2, down to genomic profiling, looking at dozens of genes to try and characterize the subset of the cancer, and now really looking at individual cancers and finding point mutations to steer us in interesting directions. So with that sort of classification background, I'll hand it back to Carolyn, who will take you through the treatment phases of the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Burstein. That was really wonderful and very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Charles Laprinzi, and Dr. Laprinzi is the Regents Professor of Breast Cancer Research, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, and Dr. Laprinzi is going to address the standard of care for ER-positive and PR-positive breast cancer and hormone therapy updates and targeted treatments and personalizing treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Laprinzi.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to do this once again and to follow Dr. Burstein, who did a very nice job of summarizing how we classify a number of breast cancers. Now, as Dr. Burstein mentioned, some of the patients who are ER-positive or hormone receptor-positive benefit from chemotherapy. All patients benefit from hormone therapy. I'm going to focus on the hormone therapy treatment, which is actually, in a way, anti-hormone therapy, anti-estrogen therapy on the whole, because of time restraints that we have here. I'm also going to clarify that I'm talking about adjuvant therapy. So a patient who has been diagnosed with a new breast cancer has had appropriate local regional therapy, surgery and or radiation, or has plans for that. And now we're thinking about giving drug therapy to be given in a adjuvant fashion, a extra fashion to try to increase the chance of curing the disease. This is opposed to patients who have a recurrence of breast cancer, which is a whole different topic that I won't focus on today now, but we could address during question period if that comes up. So I'm going to start now by talking more about the receptors on the cells, and these are the estrogen and progesterone receptors, and let's focus on estrogen receptor. Visualize a cell, and there's a part on the cell where estrogen can attach and send a message to the nucleus of the cell to say, grow and be happy and divide. We don't like that. We like to, so that we found ways to try to prevent that from happening. One of the drugs that's been around for a very, very long time is tamoxifen, and that's a molecule that attaches to the receptor where the estrogen is supposed to attach, but blocks, and since it attaches to the cell there, the estrogen can't get there and cannot stimulate the cell. And it doesn't, when it works well, doesn't stimulate the cell. So that's a common drug that we use for treating breast cancers in both premenopausal women and postmenopausal women. Another way that we try to approach, and I'll talk more about tamoxifen in a bit, but another way that we try to deal with this problem is getting rid of estrogen so there's no estrogen to attach to that receptor. So in a young woman who's been before the time of menopause, taken out the ovaries either surgically or given a medication to turn off the ovaries, something we medically call an oophorectomy, that's done to try to get rid of the estrogen that's produced by the ovaries. Now, in a postmenopausal woman, we don't do that because the ovaries are not making estrogen, but the postmenopausal women have their adrenal gland, which is right above the kidneys or renal gland. They make some androgens, some testosterone-type medications. Women do have some testosterone in them, not as much as men, but they have some. That testosterone can be converted to estrogen by the body by an enzyme called aromatase. So we have a set of drugs called aromatase inhibitors that block that conversion of testosterone to estrogen. And so in postmenopausal women, we utilize that medication to make the estrogen levels even lower. We do not use that in premenopausal women because it doesn't block the ovarian production of estrogen. Now, in premenopausal women, when we're treating them with curatively treated breast cancer now, and we're trying to improve the cure rate by giving drug therapy, tamoxifen is the mainstay of treatment that we have. If a person cannot tolerate tamoxifen, then doing ovarian function suppression or taking away ovarian function, either by removing the ovaries or giving a medication monthly to turn them off, that can be done. I don't tend to give both those things together, and most physicians do not give both, although some think about that. When patients have metastatic disease, we have some more benefit that doing both of those things could be helpful, but not in the adjuvant setting that we have. Now, if we have a premenopausal woman who has their ovaries taken out, I do not tend to add an aromatase inhibitor to that. Theoretically, when people have, for a premenopausal, they have a whole lot of estrogen in, a whole lot less if their ovaries are taken out, and you make it even smaller with giving the aromatase inhibitor. But we do not have good information at this point in time that adding that to the picture is beneficial. There are clinical trials that have been done to try to address the benefit of that process over tamoxifen, giving tamoxifen, but those trials have yet to be fully reported, even though they've entered all their patients on them. So next, let me talk a little bit more about the tamoxifen in terms of, I will talk about toxicity in a minute, but one thing that's important to know about is that tamoxifen, when you give that drug, it's not the most active form against the breast cancer, but the body converts it to another compound called endoxifen. And there's an enzyme that does that. It's called CYP2D6. I didn't name these enzymes, but that's what it's called, CYP2D6. And there are a number of drugs which can inhibit that enzyme, including a number of antidepressants and many other drugs. And so it can be important that a person who's taken tamoxifen is not taking one of those medications that prevents the conversion to the more active compound. Now, there is another whole area of thought process where people can measure how active a person's CYP2D6 enzyme is in their blood, and there's a fair amount of controversy about that over the years, but just know that some doctors in postmenopausal women recommend getting CYP2D6 levels. Other physicians are not quite convinced that it's worthwhile doing in clinical practice. Now, let me switch now to postmenopausal women. And aromatase tamoxifen is one thing that can be done in that group of patients, but aromatase inhibitors is another thing that can be done. And there were randomized trials done almost a decade ago when they were first reported that randomized patients to get tamoxifen versus an aromatase inhibitor, anastrozole was the one in this particular study, versus both. And the end result from that study was that the people who got the aromatase inhibitor, the people who got both, didn't do any better. It was not recommended they get both, but let me talk about first something else first. When they got the aromatase inhibitor, those patients did, in terms of watching how many people developed a recurrence of breast cancer, out of 7 years, they did about 3 to 4% better, 3 to 4% less recurrences in the patients who got the aromatase inhibitor versus tamoxifen. So this kind of got a lot of people excited, and we began using this medication much more than tamoxifen. However, even out now at 7, 8, 9 years, there's no difference in overall survival in the people who got the aromatase inhibitor versus the tamoxifen. And there's a number of reasons why that might be. Maybe we will see survival differences later on, but it might take 10 to 15 years, because a lot of people will live for a long time with breast cancer, even if they die from breast cancer in that situation. And also, it may be that giving the aromatase inhibitor later, if they develop a recurrence, makes up for not getting up front. And it might also be that the aromatase inhibitors have some sort of side effect. And I'm going to go in next to talk about side effects. And one of the side effects that aromatase inhibitors appear to have is that they can cause some heart troubles, more than tamoxifen. And how much more it's causing versus tamoxifen is helping heart problems, we don't know for sure. So if we do a summary of the findings of side effects with the two drugs in postmenopausal women, the aromatase inhibitors, they cause more cardiovascular troubles, like heart attacks, and it increases about one out of every 132 women who take it will have a heart attack, more than a person who might be getting tamoxifen. Bone fractures also, it causes bone thinning, and you can get more bone fractures. About one out of 50 people can get more bone fractures who get aromatase inhibitors. Thirdly, it can cause some joint aches and pains that can be prominent. They must be seen in about 50% of women, 50%, who take this medication, and up to 15%, 15%, have a problem that's so bad that says, I cannot tolerate this. It is really interfering in my life. It can cause a little bit of vaginal dryness, and it also costs a little bit more in terms of money than does tamoxifen, which is the other option that we have. Now, if we go with the side effects of tamoxifen, it can cause some blood clots. And the blood clot risk is 1 out of every 69 people, or if you round that out, 1 out of 100 or so, more than the aromatase inhibitors. And tamoxifen can cause uterus cancer or endometrial cancer. About 1 out of every 250 people who get tamoxifen can get uterus cancer. It's usually in women who are overweight and postmenopausal, and it's a curable disease in most situations if people get vaginal bleeding in the postmenopausal state and then have the surgery to take out the uterus. Now, the similar side effects, when people look at things, strokes and second cancers, neither one of those seem to be more prominent with aromatase inhibitors versus tamoxifen. So let me finish up by talking a little bit about treatment duration. A few years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, it would have been much easier to say that when we treat with tamoxifen, we treat for 5 years, and most people would stop at that time. New information has come about now that giving tamoxifen for 10 years versus 5 years, that it seems to benefit people. Now, that when they did those trials, it didn't cause benefit in terms of survival in the years between 5 and 10 when we were studying it. But the years 10 to 15 after they first had their breast cancer, there seems to be a little bit of difference, and it improves survival by about 3 percentage points. Not a big number, but so that when we have people who have been on tamoxifen for 5 years, we think about it, whether to individualize treatment based on how well they're tolerating it and what their risk of recurrence happens to be, and we'll consider going to 10 years, especially in premenopausal women. Now, aromatase inhibitor timing, 5 years is what we chose because that's what we saw was helpful for tamoxifen. There are data that are cooking right now where women had been on for 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. At that point in time, they were doing well. They didn't have any breast cancer. They were randomized to get it for another 5 years versus a placebo. And those data have all the people are entered on the study. Data are being collected, but we do not have any answer yet that longer is better. And then let me just finish up. Lastly, with the last thing is that after 5 years of tamoxifen, or sometimes 2 or 3 years of tamoxifen in the postmenopausal state, we sometimes will switch to aromatase inhibitor and oftentimes use that for 5 years. So lots more information we have, still a lot of questions. And let me stop right there and let us move on to the next topic.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much. Dr. Lipinski, that was an outstanding presentation, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Newman. And Dr. Newman is Professor of Surgery and Director, University of Michigan Breast Cancer Center. And Dr. Newman is going to address treatment updates for triple-negative breast cancer and also clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options. We are delighted to have Dr. Newman with us today, and I'm now going to turn this program over to Dr. Newman.
It's a tremendous honor to participate in this teleconference, and I'm very grateful to Dr. Carolyn Messner and the Cancer Care team for organizing the program. I'll be spending the next few minutes, as you just heard, speaking about triple-negative breast cancer, but I must emphasize that as a surgical breast oncologist, I will defer detailed comments and questions regarding systemic therapies and management of recurrent or metastatic disease to my medical oncology colleagues on this esteemed panel. Triple-negative breast cancer accounts for a minority, or only about 15%, of all the breast cancers that we diagnose in American women. But as we will also discuss, there are specific population subsets that have a higher likelihood of developing this particular type of tumor. The triple-negative breast cancers have generated substantial attention recently because they are associated with several notable features. First, they're more likely to be diagnosed in younger premenopausal women. Second, they're more likely to occur in women with hereditary susceptibility, such as BRCA1 mutation carriers. Third, they're twice as likely to be diagnosed in African-American women. And lastly, but most disturbingly, these triple-negative breast cancers do account disproportionately for an increased risk of breast cancer-related deaths. But before I go any further, I do want to emphasize here, and I will repeat this later, triple-negative breast cancers can be successfully treated, and in fact, they often are successfully treated. But prompt early detection and comprehensive multimodality therapy will enhance our likelihood of having a good outcome. Now, these tumors are called triple negative because they do not express the three markers that typically guide our systemic targeted treatment recommendations in breast cancer: the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 new marker being those very markers. Now, it's important to remember that breast cancer is comprised of a vast spectrum of different tumor biologic patterns. Being negative for these three markers still leaves room for a variety of other tumor subtypes, and we are now just beginning to gain important insights regarding the heterogeneity or differences that can exist within this important category that we pull together and call the triple negative tumors. Figuring out how to easily distinguish the various triple negative subtypes and manipulate their specific features for treatment advantages represents a very important aspect of ongoing research. But first, let's talk about detecting a triple negative breast cancer. Triple negative breast tumors are frequently detected by screening mammogram, but we all know that screening mammography is not perfect. Some cancerous lumps will seemingly pop up quite suddenly within months or even weeks of a woman having her normal annual mammogram, and we call these tumors interval breast cancers. We also know that some cancers will be detected as palpable lumps in a woman's breast that are completely invisible on mammogram. Well, it turns out that the triple negative breast cancers are more commonly found as one of these interval breast cancers, and they are also more likely to be invisible on mammogram when compared to the non-triple negative breast cancers. But I want to emphasize that this does not mean that they are always radiographically occult or invisible. I'm merely making a comparison between the frequency of triple negative tumors having a negative mammogram compared to the non-triple negative breast cancers being invisible on the mammogram. And so when a suspicious lump develops in a woman's breast, it will therefore generally require some type of biopsy to determine whether or not it represents a cancer, regardless of how the woman's mammogram looks. Breast ultrasound will often be helpful to characterize these lesions and might even be used to guide the biopsy procedure. Needle biopsies are generally preferred over surgical biopsy as a more efficient strategy to establish a breast cancer diagnosis. But if the needle biopsy is unavailable, if it's unsuccessful, or if it's simply inadequate, then a surgical biopsy should certainly be the next step. If the breast biopsy confirms the presence of a breast cancer that's negative for the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 new marker, then treatment planning should proceed expeditiously. Because the triple negative breast cancers are so closely correlated with BRCA1 mutation carrier status, we will usually refer these patients to a genetic counselor to further evaluate the possible presence of inherited susceptibility for breast cancer, regardless of the woman's family history or menopausal status. The surgical treatment options for triple negative breast cancer are actually the same as those for non-triple negative breast cancers. If the tumor is small, then breast-conserving surgery consisting of lumpectomy and radiation or mastectomy with or without breast reconstruction can be offered. These cancers routinely require axillary staging to determine the status of the lymph nodes or the glands in the underarm area. And this can sometimes be accomplished by a needle biopsy, but more often requires a surgical procedure called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. If either the axillary needle biopsy or a sentinel lymph node biopsy reveals evidence of cancer hiding in the underarm glands, then that's going to be a pretty powerful clue that the woman might also have microscopic cancer cells hiding elsewhere in her body, such as in her liver, lungs, bones, and this is what we call micrometastatic disease. This micrometastatic disease burden is usually not going to be apparent on x-rays such as CAT scans or bone scans. Now, chemotherapy is extremely effective at killing or eliminating the micrometastatic disease burden in a woman's body, and so the lymph node information can be critical in defining the life-saving value of chemotherapy. We've also learned over the years that triple-negative breast cancers tend to be exquisitely sensitive to chemotherapy. Since many of the triple-negative breast cancers that we detect are biologically more rapidly growing and therefore more aggressive, we as clinicians do tend to be more inclined to recommend chemotherapy for a triple-negative breast cancer, even if the lymph nodes are negative. Sometimes we will recommend chemotherapy prior to the woman's surgery, because this preoperative treatment will often shrink the tumor down and improve the woman's eligibility for a lumpectomy and breast-saving surgical procedures. Some patients will choose to receive preoperative chemotherapy because it gives them more time to complete the genetic counseling process and/or because it might give them more time to decide between the lumpectomy or mastectomy surgical options. Following the primary cancer treatment, which will often include a combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, the triple-negative breast cancer patients do require ongoing close follow-up to monitor for any evidence of local or distant disease recurrence. Treatment failure from breast cancer, unfortunately, can occur anywhere and at any time, but it has been shown that brain metastases are more likely to occur in the triple-negative breast cancers compared to the non-triple-negative breast cancers. Another interesting feature of the triple-negative breast cancer cases is that the vast majority of triple-negative breast cancer recurrences occur in the first 5 years after treatment. And so that five-year celebratory survivorship benchmark is especially exciting for the triple-negative breast cancer patient. I'd like to wind down by commenting briefly on some very exciting research directions with triple-negative breast cancer. Our wonderful basic science laboratory investigators and our medical oncologists have made wonderful advances with novel systemic therapeutic approaches in triple-negative breast cancer, such as use of cisplatinum agents, PARP inhibitors, anti-angiogenic agents, and anti-growth factor agents. We are now looking to subtype the triple-negative breast cancers based upon expression of alternative markers, such as those for mammary stem cells and the androgen receptor. And this body of work will likely have important treatment implications in the very near future. My own research involves the study of breast cancer disparities related to racial ethnic identity. And as we mentioned previously, triple-negative breast cancer is twice as common in African-American women compared to white American women, and our work looking at the breast cancer burden of women in the continent of Africa has shown that triple-negative breast cancer actually accounts for the majority of breast cancers found in this part of the world. This ongoing international work is therefore quite promising as a resource for understanding breast cancer disparities here in the United States, since African ancestry in and of itself might be associated with a heritable risk factor or marker for triple-negative breast cancer. This international research partnership also represents a unique strategy for understanding the various triple-negative breast cancer subtypes, since we don't actually know at this point in time whether the triple-negative breast cancers that we see so frequently in women with African ancestry are the same triple-negative breast cancer patterns that account for the minority of breast cancers that are diagnosed in women with European ancestry. And in closing, I want to emphasize a few vital messages. Number one, even though we worry about triple-negative breast cancers being a relatively more aggressive form of breast cancer, it is still a treatable form of breast cancer. Number two, early detection of triple-negative breast cancer is critical, just as early detection is life-saving for women with non-triple-negative breast cancers. And so screening with regular mammography, as well as breast MRI as appropriate for selected high-risk women, and prompt biopsy of any suspicious breast mass is essential. Lastly, the research in understanding triple-negative breast cancer subtypes and identifying markers for subtype-specific treatment is exciting, promising, and this work deserves the support of both philanthropic and organized funding agency dollars. And so I thank you for your time and attention, and I will again turn the program over to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Newman. That was an extraordinary presentation. I want to thank Dr. Newman very much for her excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Larissa Corday. And Dr. Corday is Assistant Professor, Division of Medical Oncology, University of Washington. She's Director, Prevention Center, Shared Resource, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Assistant Member, Public Health Sciences and Clinical Research Divisions, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Corday is going to address practical tips to cope with treatment side effects and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Corday.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. So as Carolyn mentioned, I'll be talking about some practical tips for management of treatment-related toxicities. I'm going to talk some about side effects and treatment toxicities in premenopausal women and also talk about some side effects and treatments in postmenopausal women, specifically related to aromatase inhibitors, which you heard a little bit about already from Dr. Loprinzi. So the few topics that I'd like to cover today include fertility issues and fertility preservation in premenopausal women, management of menopausal symptoms, which can occur either temporarily or permanently from chemotherapy and can also be related to hormonal therapies, specifically some symptoms related to aromatase inhibitors, including muscle and joint pain, and finally, I'd like to just speak a little bit about bone health and management of bone health in women that are taking hormonal therapy for breast cancer. So we know that chemotherapy can result in either temporary or permanent cessation of menses. And in young women, this obviously can lead to issues of fertility, particularly in women that are very young, which is rare with breast cancer, but certainly does occur. In any woman, whether she's pre- or postmenopausal, to begin with, there can be a number of symptoms, including hot flashes and vaginal dryness. And as I mentioned, hormonal therapies for breast cancer, such as tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors, can also either cause or exacerbate menopausal symptoms. So I'd like to start a little bit with a discussion about the fertility effects of breast cancer treatment. In women who are premenopausal, chemotherapy will often cause at least temporary cessation of menstrual periods. And in young women who've not yet completed their childbearing, there's certainly concern about permanent loss of fertility. The risk of permanent menopause with chemotherapy is related to a number of factors, including the specific chemotherapy agents that are used, the doses of these drugs. So, for example, the doses that we use for treatment of breast cancer may actually be lower than doses used for treatments of things like leukemia, and so that can have an effect on the likelihood that menopause will occur. And then finally, and probably most importantly, the age at which a woman undergoes treatment is very strongly related to whether or not she may experience permanent menopause. For example, a woman who goes through chemotherapy in her late 20s is actually much less likely to experience permanent menopause than a woman who's in her late 40s. In terms of coping with this, I think one of the take-home messages that I'd like to give is that really communication with the healthcare team is key. And so if childbearing is something that a woman's thinking about when she's diagnosed with breast cancer, then this is something that should be brought up right away in terms of when her treatment plan is being identified, so that if menopause and fertility are issues, then that's something that can be discussed before treatment has started. For women who hope to preserve their fertility, there are a number of things that can be considered prior to starting chemotherapy. For example, embryo cryopreservation, which is also known as in vitro fertilization or IVF, may be an option for a woman that has an identified partner. And it's important, really, that this is something that be thought about before chemotherapy is started, because egg harvesting and embryo freezing would have to occur before chemotherapy, so before a woman goes into at least temporary menopause. For women who are not currently partnered or who are single, there is some data looking at what's called oocyte or egg cryopreservation, and that involves just harvesting eggs and freezing them with the goal of having those fertilized in the future in vitro and then implanted. This is not as well studied as IVF, but it is potentially an option. It is important to note that these can often be very expensive procedures, and insurance coverage is, some insurances do cover it, but certainly not all. There are some charity dollars available for this, including through the Livestrong Foundation. So again, it's something that a woman who is newly diagnosed with breast cancer should certainly discuss with her physician if that's an important issue. There are some studies looking at whether suppressing ovarian function during chemotherapy by using a medication such as one that Dr. Loprinzi mentioned to shut down the ovaries might be a way to help preserve fertility. That's primarily been studied in women with hormone receptor negative breast cancer, and it is still considered experimental but may be an option. I'd like to turn now to talking about symptoms that can accompany menopause, whether that's temporary or permanent menopause. Many women, up to about 65% of women with breast cancer, experience symptoms such as hot flashes or night sweats, and these can vary in terms of the severity and the quantity of symptoms experienced. The first step in managing these is really with lifestyle modifications, and so some of the things we suggest include keeping a hot flash diary to identify triggers and to avoid those triggers. Some common triggers include spicy foods, caffeine intake, and alcohol. Often we recommend trying to keep the body temperature cool, and this can be accomplished by dressing in layers so that layers can be either put on or removed depending on the surrounding temperature and the body temperature, and often keeping a fan handy, and for women that are experiencing night sweats, sleeping in a cool room. There's also some research suggesting that women who are regular exercisers have a lower risk or lower severity of hot flashes, so I think this is an important strategy, and also avoidance of smoking is important. If these measures are not effective, or if they are somewhat effective but severe symptoms still occur, then there are medications that can be used. These include some antidepressant medications, most commonly SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. And examples of these include Effexor, also called venlafaxine, or Zoloft, also called sertraline. And as Dr. Loprinzi mentioned, it's important to think about whether there are potential interactions between certain medications and tamoxifen, specifically in the CYP2D6 pathway. So again, this is something where good communication with your healthcare team, including the physician and the pharmacist, are important. There are other medications that have been studied. One of them is gabapentin or Neurontin, and another one is clonidine, which is actually a blood pressure medication and is available as a patch. So multiple different strategies are available. Some strategies work well for some women and others don't. And so choosing a medication with your physician is really important. There's also been some research on mind-body or alternative approaches, such as hypnosis, acupuncture, and yoga. And some supplements have also been studied, things like vitamin E and black cohosh. And in general, unfortunately, studies with these supplements have really only been shown that supplements can be either similar to placebo or maybe slightly better, but I don't think that there's really any kind of a slam dunk or home run medication for management of hot flashes. And it's important to note that as mentioned by other speakers, that for hormone receptor positive breast cancers, our treatments are really aimed at either reducing estrogen concentrations in the body or reducing the effects of estrogen. So supplements that might be estrogenic really should be avoided in this setting. I want to turn now to talk a little bit about muscle and joint pain related to aromatase inhibitors. It's estimated that about 30% of women on aromatase inhibitors experience muscle and joint pain or stiffness, and again, there is some variability to this in terms of who develops these symptoms and then also how severe they are. There's also an increased risk of things like carpal tunnel syndrome, trigger fingers, or muscle cramping, and so again, this is something that can be discussed with the physician. Symptoms also appear to be related to certain other factors. So women that are obese or overweight have a higher likelihood of developing symptoms. Women who have had prior chemotherapy use for treatment of their breast cancer, and also women with prior use of hormone replacement therapy appear to be more likely to develop these symptoms. When the symptoms are severe, this can be really important in determining whether or not a woman will stay on her therapy. And as other speakers have mentioned, these treatments really are effective for reducing the risk of recurrence of cancer, and so it's really important to talk about management of these symptoms. There are three different aromatase inhibitors, and it seems that muscle and joint symptoms are equally common with each of these medications, so it doesn't appear that one is a worse offender than the others. Sometimes, though, women who are taking one aromatase inhibitor and switch to another one will have improvement of their symptoms, and so that's one strategy. Generally, what we recommend as sort of a first step in women that are experiencing severe symptoms is to take what's called a drug holiday. So basically, what we want to do is to stop the medication temporarily to just confirm that the symptoms are really related to the medication and not to any other things that might be going on at the same time. If the medication is truly the cause of the symptoms, so if the symptoms really get better when somebody's off the aromatase inhibitor, then one strategy would be, as I mentioned, switching to a different AI. And another strategy potentially would be switching to tamoxifen. And again, I think managing this in the long term with a conversation back and forth with your healthcare team is really very important. There have been studies looking at other medications to alleviate side effects, and I think this is sort of a new field and a field of active research. Supplements such as vitamin D have been looked at, and things like acupuncture have also been looked at. So again, I don't know that there's definitive evidence that these things help, but there certainly is some promising evidence, and so I think this is something that we'll likely hear much more about in the future. For the last topic I'd like to address quite briefly is bone loss from aromatase inhibitors. Many studies have shown that bone loss is accelerated in women who take aromatase inhibitors. We know that as a woman goes through menopause and ages, that bone loss will generally occur, but that this process may be faster in women that are on AIs. So we generally do recommend that bone density is monitored in women taking aromatase inhibitors. In general, in postmenopausal women, they should be having a DEXA scan, which is a bone density scan done at least every 2 years. And in women on AIs or those who have other risk factors for osteoporosis, we would recommend that this be done once a year. In women who already have osteoporosis, sometimes we think about not using an aromatase inhibitor. And as Dr. Loprinzi mentioned, there are ways to use either tamoxifen in combination with an aromatase inhibitor, usually in sequence, either tamoxifen first and then the AI or vice versa, that can be recommended in as an alternative strategy to just using an aromatase inhibitor. In women who do either develop osteopenia or osteoporosis on an AI or who have had that prior to starting the aromatase inhibitor, there are medications that can be used to support bone health. There are a number of options, including oral medications, oral bisphosphonates, such as Fosamax or Boniva. There's also an IV bisphosphonate called zoledronic acid, or called Reclast. And there's one newer option, which is a medication called denosumab or Prolia, which is given as a subcutaneous injection every 6 months. I will mention again that insurance coverage can be an issue, particularly for these IV or sub-Q medications that can be quite costly, and so that's certainly something that a physician and the patient need to discuss together to try to figure out what's the most effective and the most sort of friendly or lifestyle-friendly option. I do want to mention that there are some data suggesting that bisphosphonates, particularly IV bisphosphonates, may actually reduce the chance of breast cancer recurrence, but there's been conflicting evidence in this arena, and so we're not quite sure that this should be used routinely as a means of preventing cancer recurrence, but that's certainly something that's out there. And really, I think the choice of whether or not to use one of these bisphosphonate therapies or denosumab should primarily be based on whether or not osteopenia or osteoporosis is present. I'd just like to close by mentioning that because side effects from therapies are very common and that there are available options for treatment, it's really important to discuss these issues with your healthcare team. This could be your physician, it could be a nurse practitioner on the team, or your primary nurse or a patient navigator. And it's important that this be an ongoing conversation because there aren't always just quick fixes for some of these side effects, but I think with time and with conversation, there are a number of both lifestyle approaches and medication approaches that can be used. And so communication is really one of the keys to managing these side effects. So with that, I'd like to close and turn things back over to Dr. Messner. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Corday, for just a wonderful presentation and lots of information. And our next speaker is Allison Nilsen. Allison is an oncology social worker. She's coordinator of Women's Cancers Program at Cancer Care. And Allison is going to review with you the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Allison.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm an oncology social worker, and I work with many women coping with breast cancer and their loved ones. I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, support groups, which are offered face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by a licensed, master-level social worker and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you probably know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family, and asking for help is a sign of strength. The good news is that you do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about cancer. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a support group over the telephone for women coping with metastatic breast cancer. And there are also online groups available for women with both early stage and advanced breast cancer. Finally, women with cancer in the New York tri-state area can attend our face-to-face in-person support groups. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our comprehensive website at www.cancercare.org to read more. We recognize that women with triple-negative breast cancer have unique needs and concerns. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation has partnered with Cancer Care to offer free professional support services to anyone coping with a diagnosis of triple negative breast cancer. The TNBC helpline is staffed by experienced oncology social workers with specific knowledge of triple negative disease. To speak to one of our expert social workers, please call 877-880-TNBC. And you can learn more online at www.tnbcfoundation.org. As we have learned a lot from today's breast cancer program, you might need some guidance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. But remember, you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, thank you so much, Allison. That was a wonderful presentation. And now we have time for questions, and we have I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions and to bring all of our speakers on board, and let's see how many of your questions we can take. If we don't get your question, please call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. And I'm showing our first question comes from the line of Nancy G. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question is, I'm not quite sure what the aromatase inhibitors are. I was told by my oncologist to use Femara, and I hadn't heard that mentioned. Is that one of the aromatase inhibitors?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Thank you. Dr. Lipinski, could you address that question, please?
I certainly can. There are three aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole, letrozole, and exemestane, and their brand names are Arimidex, Femara, which you talked about there, and Aromacin. So that is one of the three aromatase inhibitors. They're all quite similar to each other in terms of clinical practice issues, some differences between the molecules.
Excellent. And we have another question from our online participants, actually. The question is, can you explain a bit more about what is meant by interval breast cancers? Are these cancers more aggressive since they develop between regular screenings? Dr. Burstein, could you address that?
Sure. As Lisa said, there are cancers that are found on screening detection once a year. When you go for a mammogram and they say there's something abnormal there and they want to get a further workup and there's a diagnosis made of breast cancer. In between those appointments, women occasionally find a lump in the breast or a physical exam by a clinician suggests an abnormality. And those are what we call interval breast cancers. They are found in the interval between the mammogram evaluations. And the triple negative cancers, as Lisa referred to, are a little more likely to be found as interval cancers, and that's because we think they have a faster growth rate. So while the mammogram is better at finding the slower growing, more indolent ER-positive breast cancers, triple negative cancers often sort of pop up in between. Also, triple-negative cancers are a little more common in younger women, including women less than age 40, and younger women often have mammograms that are a little more difficult to read because of breast density. So those are a couple of reasons why you find more interval cancers that are triple-negative.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants, and the question is, in metastatic PR-positive breast cancer, which tumor markers are most effective to follow to see if treatment is working? Dr. Lipinski, can you address that?
So in metastatic disease, and we didn't really talk about metastatic much, but I said I would be able to address it with questions. So the question is, which tumor markers to follow? And so in a patient who has metastatic breast cancer, and I start a medication to try to treat that breast cancer, my next job every time I see that patient or think about the patient is to determine whether or not the cancer is clearly better, has shrunk down with the therapy, or is clearly worse, which we don't like to see, but we need to say, but we'd like to note it if it's there, or about the same, and then decide what to do from there. And the question is, what do I use to help to make those determinations? The two, by far and above, the two most important things is to talk to the patient and to examine the patient, so history and physical examination. Sometimes a X-ray test may show it. If a person had nodules on a chest X-ray, you can do that. Sometimes it requires a more detailed X-ray, like a PET scan, CT scan or something like that. That's much more expensive. And we do those intermittently, not necessarily every time we see them, but intermittently, and depends on the case. Sometimes there are blood markers that can obtain. You can get a blood sample. Sometimes we get blood samples to see how the liver works and how the kidney works and all those sorts of things. But there can be more specific things that can be markers of the cancer. A CA2729 or a CA153 are markers that are used. Or sometimes doctors will get a sample to see if they can see some circulating tumor cells when they make the diagnosis and later on. And those are used occasionally. There's a lot of pros and cons to using those. Sometimes it provides you a little bit too much information. Sometimes we use those if it's mainly in the bones because the X-rays can't tell things very far. So those are the markers that we use, but it has to be individualized a lot patient to patient. And different doctors depend more or less on tests, and that's not necessarily good or bad. It's just the way they practice. Hal, Dr. Burstein, other things to add to that?
Yeah, you know, I think the point you make about trying to integrate the physical exam, the patient's symptoms, and the other data is really the important one. Sometimes people get very concerned about very small changes on X-rays or on small bumps in tumor markers, and it's very easy to overinterpret those. And so we always try to focus, again, on how the patient's doing, what the physical exam suggests, then add to that this full picture of the laboratory data and the radiological studies, and that's really how we gauge whether the cancer is getting worse or not, or whether it's responding to treatment, and trying to integrate that whole thing is an incredibly important task.
Yeah, and I think along that same line, Dr. Burson and I practice similarly to this. If a patient is feeling well and the examination is good, then the other things are not near so important. It's actually not really important to find it when it starts to grow the least amount, because we have other drugs that we can use frequently, but there's not a big hurry to have to use those things.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you. You have been an extraordinary panel of expert speakers today. I want to thank each of you. I want to thank all of you who've actually, both online and on the telephone, asked questions. I know that some of you have questions in addition to what we've asked today, so please do contact Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-4673. Our staff are here to answer your questions. And most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer, with breast cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support. We're here to help you, and we are simply a telephone call away, or you can visit our website as well. So thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.